from Cabernet to Monet. They're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Jen.
And we are the art history babes.
Art history babes.
We're sans Natalie today. She's out there on the scene.
On the art scene.
She's on the art scene. So today we are going to talk about one of our favorite problematic babes, Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
Man.
There's a lot to say.
I just love him, but he's such a fucking weirdo. So yeah, I can't wait to talk about how weird he is.
Weird is a bit of an understatement.
Yeah. Yes. I know. I have that quote from him. I am not strange. I am just not normal. It's like, no, you were strange.
No, you're actually strange.
You weren't normal.
You weren't normal.
But you were strange.
You were beyond strange. And also, I've stated it over and over again, he is easily my most problematic fave because mm-hmm. I have a very personal connection with Dali, and he's also the worst.
Yeah, he's pretty bad, and I'm glad that we're talking about Dali because I was thinking about Salvador Dali, and I was thinking about how he is this sort of he's a cultural phenomenon.
Definitely.
In the sense that people who don't know anything about art or
Dali.
Art history.
Yeah.
Know Dali.
Yeah.
Know the melting clocks.
Yeah.
Know the big long leg elephants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the other night at the local ye olde pub, a girl was hanging out with us, and she had the tattoo that I've seen a million times. Not to disparage her choice of tattoo, but we've seen it with the long leg elephants or the long leg. I think it's a giraffe or a horse.
I don't even
something.
Know, honestly.
But, so she had it on her arm, and it's just something that I thought, huh, it's really, I wonder what it is about this weirdo that we are so fascinated by. And so we're going to unpack some of that today.
Yeah, definitely. It's really hard to say because I know I've told this story on the podcast before, but and it's almost now that I'm so deep in art history, I kind of find it boring. But when I was in middle school, Salvador Dali is what got me into art because I didn't have, my family wasn't particularly into visual art for the most part. My mom kind of liked photography, but it wasn't a big thing in my house. And I was just at my local library in middle school, and I was art. And I pulled out a Salvador Dali book, and I was just and I didn't understand any of it. And that I loved everything about it. I loved how much I didn't understand it. And from there on out, he was my favorite artist, and I got really into art. So he's responsible for that.
So thanks.
Thank you, Salvador.
And that's a common thing. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit too. But yeah, it's a total cultural phenomenon. Everyone just went apeshit for Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
And still kind of do.
People still do. And I think it has something to do with there's a timelessness to his work. Almost every work by Dali doesn't elicit a certain period in time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's nothing historical
that
is referencing anything that is happening in the world necessarily. I mean, obviously once you start to deconstruct a work, he's not just working in a bubble.
Yeah.
But there's something about just the hyper smooth sort of realism to his figures. There's a crispness. There's and there's a lot of this hearkening to the sort of golden age of classical art. So I feel he employs the language of classical forms in his bodies.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's crazy.
Yeah, his compositions are insane.
Out of control.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot about his choices that make him a timeless artist.
Yeah, definitely. And that make him compelling and interesting and make you like step back and go like, what is happening?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Salvador Dali. So he was a lot of things. This man was a lot of stuff.
just all kinds of stuff.
He really was. Okay, so he, you know, he's most well known as a surrealist painter. Like, that's kind of what everyone thinks of him. Surrealism, just like quick bare bones definition, if you're unfamiliar, is a style. It's a cultural movement, but it's associated often with visual art, and it's a style that seeks to kind of explore the dream world or explore the way, like,
the subconscious.
Yeah, the subconscious and the way our dreams and reality kind of work together. That's the easiest way to describe a surrealist painting. It kind of looks like a dream, you know? Things don't really make sense. Right. And so he's a surrealist painter. He was also an inventor. He studied.
Of course he was. Of course he was. I didn't know that. That makes sense, though.
Yeah, he would just, like, make, like, furniture and shit. Like, really? Out of, yeah.
Sure, why not?
Are you familiar with Bakelite?
No.
It was this stuff that was, like, it was, like, a material that was supposed to, from what I understand, it was supposed to, like, form to you in some way.
Oh.
Yeah. And he would, like, make furniture out of it.
What?
I've
never heard of that before.
Yeah. So he just liked to experiment. So he was, like, a little inventor. He studied philosophy from a really young age. He was really into Kant. And and Nietzsche as but he was really into philosophy and psychoanalysis, which those are my favorite artists, are the ones that are really into philosophy and psychology. I just think it really adds to their artistic output. But he also wrote scripts, he illustrated books, he designed furniture and clothing, he created theatrical scenery and costumes, he choreographed a ballet.
Oh, that's right.
He worked in film, which I'll talk about a little bit more, but, like, he worked with Hitchcock, he worked with Disney, he was originally, like, on Fantasia, like, working on Fantasia before he, like, got the boot.
Yeah, they were like,
him and Kate Nelson both got kicked to the curb.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But there is another work he did with Disney that it was never finished, and then someone finished it
that, like, more recent one?
Yeah.
That looks like a Dolly painting?
Yes.
That one's super cool. Look it up on YouTube. Watch it.
Just look up, like, Salvador Dali and Disney. It'll come up. Right. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It I saw it and was like, whoa.
Yeah. No, it's great. and it's clear. Yeah, it's very clearly Dali. And it came from his sketches, and it was like a work in progress that never got finished. But yeah, so he did all these things. He also was a huge narcissist. Like,
no.
The definition of narcissism.
Dali?
What? So many narcissists in the world.
Oh yeah, but he was...
Narcissi. Yes. Real world.
he was on another level of narcissism. Kind of a Renaissance man, if you want to use that terminology. He was born May 11th, 1904. He claimed to have memories from in utero.
Wow. Of course he did.
Yeah, because
I claimed that as well until I was like 8.
What do you remember?
Well, I think it was one of those like false memories you create for yourself, because I was like, I remember floating in an inner tube in the liquids in my mother's stomach.
Your mom probably was like, she is a prophet.
Crystal child.
Like, just like briefly having met your mom.
Yeah.
I feel like your mom would have like believed that and like consulted her psychic about
definitely
her past life.
And who knows, maybe those are real memories.
You never know.
I hope so.
Yeah. And likewise, Salvador, maybe you did.
Kindred
like
spirits.
Yeah. maybe you're him reincarnated.
He
died in 89.
Yeah.
But Ginny is a pleasure to have in your life.
But that's the thing about reincarnation. You're supposed to, like, learn in your life and come back a better person.
Do you learned to be less of a shit?
Yeah.
Came back as our loving, adorable Ginny?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to, like, wake up in the middle of the night just like, oh.
Yeah, we're already getting real weird with this. Okay.
Well, it's fitting.
It is. It's very fitting. So, He claims to have memories from in utero. This is kind of trippy. So he's born 9 months after his brother, also named Salvador, died.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he lived his whole life, like, having, like, intense, weird anxiety and, like, guilt about his dead brother.
Yeah, because his parents believed that he was the, like, first Salvador reincarnated.
That is fucked
up. So, Ginny, you're both the Salvadors.
Whoa! That's fucking weird.
I know. So his parents believed, you know, he was his brother reincarnated. And then, you know, we've heard this story because, like, we talked about it in our Getting Graphic episode about the graphic novelist who felt he was living in his dead brother's, like, shadow.
Yeah, Art Spiegelman.
Yeah, Art Spiegelman. So, and I've heard it.
Yeah, that would do a number on you.
Yeah, it's just, like, you hear it a lot of this, like, you know, one sibling dies and then you're kind of, like, living up to that sibling. So, Salvador Dali was kind of, he kind of saw himself as a substitute for the first Salvador. But as a child, he was very much doted on by his mother. She was very attentive towards him. He played by himself a lot.
Oh, I relate to that.
I do, too.
We all do. You got a...
We're all pretty much only children.
Yeah, you got a table of, like, only children here. But he played by himself. But the thing is, I think it was also partially just because he was a narcissist. Because he would dress himself as a king and observe himself in a mirror.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there are also stories of... You know, we're just going to dive right in. There are stories that he also would masturbate doing this, like, dressed as a king in the mirror.
I've heard of men masturbating in the mirror. I don't know what the hell that is. That is some weird, trippy shit.
If that's what you're into, that's totally fine. It's more, honestly, the dressed as a king in a mirror thing that kind of gets me.
That's
a little, but... Whatever, it just screams narcissism.
So, he just had, like, a king outfit?
Yeah! I don't know.
Like, where did he just get one?
I don't know the details. How, like, authentic it was.
Yeah. It was just, it was like, when you make a crown out of, like, construction paper.
I'm just,
like, a jewel on it.
This is so bad. I'm just envisioning, like, one of those, like, Burger King, like, little crowns. Like, and, like, a towel for, like, a cape or something.
Probably.
Oh, boy.
Good way to imagine
I'm
it.
Stop thinking about that.
So yeah, he was pretty much he was concerned with death and eroticism, like, straight out the gate.
Yeah,
like, these were they're heavy themes in his work. They're things he's interested in. Let's be real, who isn't? They're fascinating,
right?
Death and eroticism. Let's talk about them all day long.
But like, not just eroticism though. Like, he had, like, intense, like, sexual, like, neurosis.
Yeah,
like, he was, like, real freaked out. Anecdote time. His dad left a book out one day of a bunch. It was a medical textbook, and in it were just images, like, real pictures of people with advanced venereal diseases. And he saw that as a young kid and was, like, horrified but also, like, fascinated, and that, like, really impacted him, like, in his life.
Huh.
Was, like, a fear, like, a super intense fear of venereal disease and, like, genital, like, mutilation.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but yeah, he definitely had impotence issues that kind of arose, and they, you know, can arguably be seen in his work sometimes as well.
For sure,
Eroticism, sexuality, kind of a complex but obviously, like, horrifying thing to him, but also, like, a fascination, which is another thing you see with Dali, like, being fascinated with horrifying things. That's, you know, which I get, but it's also like, whoa.
I get it, but whoa.
Yeah. February 1921, Dali's mom dies. Which was really hard on him because he had a close relationship with her. And then his father remarried his mother's sister.
Oh, weird. Yeah.
You gotta do that.
I know.
What a douche. Who does that, dude?
I know. I mean, I think maybe it's one of those things that, like, different time, it might be a little more, like...
Nah, dude. No. That's, like, universally not okay. Also, this was only, like... It was less than 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. I think of it in this, like, almost like marriage out of necessity, but it probably wasn't.
I get what you mean, in terms of survival.
And you're already connected because they're like family.
Right. Plenty of and, kings. But he came like, from Henry like, Tudor married right. his brother's
exactly.
wife.
So I'm thinking of it like that, yeah. but at the same time, this is 1920s. Yeah. I don't know.
They were banging on the side.
I don't know if that's the
wife
truth.
Dies.
I don't know.
Marries the sister. I don't. That's what happened. I called it. That's the story.
There's no evidence for that.
Or he's like,
I mean, maybe.
Cite that source.
Yeah, but
cite me
as Jen, art history major.
Yeah.
Dali, when he's a teenager, he goes to art school in Madrid. Starts studying cubism on his own because cubism's like, you know, really big at this time. Mm-hmm. He starts like studying it on his own because basically he just like doesn't think that his professors can teach and like he doesn't think they know shit.
Of course. He's a narcissist.
He's a narcissist. And they also weren't like teaching cubism and stuff. So, I mean, you know, he's kind of right. But he's basically just like doesn't have a good attitude. All right. He's got a bad attitude.
He has an attitude problem.
He's got a serious.
He's got a fucking attitude.
He's got an attitude problem, which eventually gets him banished from the academy. Because they're like, we just don't want to fuck with this guy anymore.
Yep.
But while he's there, he meets Louis Bunuel, which is kind of how he gets started hanging out with the Surrealists. In 1928. He's hanging out with Bunuel. He's hanging out with the Surrealists. The two of them together make a film called Un Chien Andalou.
Right.
It's a short film. It's on YouTube. We'll post it. And it's just a trippy-ass surreal film.
It grosses me out.
It's a lot of weird going on. And it...
That's where they do, like, the eyeball getting squished, right?
Well, it's getting
slicing.
Oh, that's right.
If you haven't seen it, and you should, it's short. If you haven't seen it, you may be familiar with the image of a woman's eyeball being cut because that became one of the defining images.
Right,
because
people were horrified.
Yeah.
People thought it was real.
And it's not comfortable to watch. I mean, in a sense, it was real. It was a cow's eye.
That's right.
That was being cut.
Right, but it wasn't like her eye.
It wasn't her eye, but still, it was, you know, it wasn't like...
Yeah.
It was an actual eye.
Yeah, in the 1920s, people are not aware of a lot of the tricks of films.
Yeah.
They were like, oh!
But there's a lot of other weird shit, too. Like, there's, like, ants, like, coming out of this guy's hand. So it's just, like, nightmarish. I mean, not nightmare, like, horrible, but, like, there's some creepy stuff going on.
Yeah.
But it's really good. You should check it out. They also made The Golden Age, which... I haven't watched yet, but I think is also on YouTube. It's much longer. It's like an hour long. They made that together, and it ended up being prohibited in France and couldn't be shown for 50 years.
Hilarious.
I know.
So, like, the country banned
it?
Oh, my God.
Not for 50 years.
I need to watch that now.
And then, yeah, the two of them... Basically, as you would expect with Dali being a huge narcissist, they just can't see eye to eye on things. No pun intended. And things fall apart. Surprise, surprise. Summer of 1929, he meets Gala, who at the time is married to Paul Eluard. And the two of them, Gala and Paul Eluard, are in an open relationship, a very open relationship, and they kind of have, like, this poly thing going on with Max Ernst for a while.
Dude.
Yeah.
Ménage à trois.
Yeah, they're just, like, living together and just loving on each other.
Whoa.
Which is kind of, you know, very...
Max Ernst is amazing.
Yeah.
I know, I was like, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very 1920s. Paris.
It's a boheme scene.
It's a boheme.
Dali falls in love with Gala, like, right away.
She was a stunning lady.
She's very stunning. And he has done many works of her, many portraits and things. They got married in 1956. So quite, like, many years later. But obviously they kind of got involved right away because, you know, it was like a... It was an open, fluid thing.
Yeah.
And she was, so they get married. So she leaves Eluard and they get married in 1956. He considered her like a muse, a model, and a manager.
The three M's.
The three M's.
Wow.
So she was like, she was just on top of everything. Like, she made the Dali that became the Dali.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
In fact, he signed many of his paintings, Gala Salvador Dali.
Ooh.
I know.
Oh my God. You know what that reminds me of? That reminds me of when John Lennon changed his middle name to Ono.
Oh, yeah.
And started going by John Ono Lennon.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I just randomly remember that.
Yeah.
True love.
Get you a man's that takes your name.
Also, he credited her with curing his impotence. So.
Sure.
No small feat.
Wow.
Pressure.
Yeah, right.
Lots of pressure. So they have a very interesting love story. Pretty much anything, like any biography you find on Salvador Dali or documentary talks a lot about her. She's often painted as kind of a femme fatale figure.
Yeah.
And kind of rightfully so. Like, she was, you know, beautiful and enchanting and also just did her thing.
She was the muse of many of the surrealist artists.
Yeah. So she was a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
Very much ahead of her time, too, it seems like. Whoa.
Just sort of like a badass babe, pissing off dudes, making other dudes fall in love.
Exactly. Which is what we all just hope to be, is it not?
For real. Pissing them off and making them fall in love.
Not to mention...
Sometimes at the same time.
Yeah. Not to mention, late in life, Salvador Dali buys Gala a castle, like 50 miles from where he lives.
I love this.
Because she's like, buy me a castle. And so he just did.
I want a castle, but I want it, like, far away from you. Okay. Whatever you want.
At least a half hour's drive.
Yeah. So she's very interesting figure in his life. At 37, Dali wrote his autobiography, The Secret Life of Salvador Dali. I haven't read it, but from what I can tell, from what I've read, he draws this picture of himself as eccentric, enigmatic, and godly, if that surprises you at all.
Wow.
Kind of like he does this thing from, at least from like the review I read, the more he discloses things about himself just to make himself seem more mysterious. Going into the problematic aspects, he was like a low-key fascist.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It basically, okay, so there's this, it's like article blog post that we'll put on our sources that you should all read because it goes a little more into detail, but it's called "It's Really Surreal How Salvador Dali Was a Fascist Who Hit Women."
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm going to look that up right now.
By Lauren Euler. And it's basically the author is rightfully calling out Salvador Dali for his bullshit, because we like to look at him as this genius, but it's like he was a fuck too.
Oh, totally.
So he was fascinated by Hitler, which showed up in his work. And on some level, like, just being fascinated by a figure, you can't.
He was also anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Dali was?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, exactly. So he was fascinated by Hitler.
I'm fascinated by Hitler in the sense that I'm like, what is your fucking problem?
Yeah, like, but it wasn't like that. He was legitimately fascinated
by
him.
Right,
and,
right.
And the other surrealists were, you know, very political, like a lot of artists are.
Sure.
And they saw his kind of fascination and his unwillingness to support their social stance as fascism, which kind of was. There's actually a story I'm going to read. I'm pulling out of my book. So I have this Dali book, and I pulled it out to research yesterday, and I found these pressed flowers in it that I totally forgot about, and it was, like, really magical.
That is so magical.
It is. So I suggest to all of you, it's something I do sometimes. I just, like, you know, throw flowers in random-ass books and totally forget about it. And, like, I've done this a few times, and one day down the road, you're going to pull that book out, and it's just going to make you smile. So
it is really cool to
just
leave
do that
stuff in a book.
Yeah, definitely.
I need to do that more.
I had that the other day. I went through a book, and I left some little note in there about, I was, like, all heartbroken over some boyfriend, like, 10 years ago. I was like, ha!
Have you ever...
That guy sucked.
Have you ever found notes in library books?
No.
Yes.
That is so fun.
What?
Leave little notes in your library
book. I'm
going
to start doing that.
Yeah, it's so fun.
Just notes like, you will be okay.
Yeah. Oh. Or little doodles.
Or like weird stuff.
Yeah.
Like, don't get the chicken chow fun. Like, what?
Yeah, so just little life tips. Okay, but anyways, back to his fascism.
Yes, yes.
In 1933, he criticized the foreign policies of the Soviet Union and professed to be fascinated by Hitler. When Dali exhibited his painting, The Riddle of William Tell, in the Salon of the Independent at the beginning of 1934, it came to a head. The picture was understood as ridiculing Lenin. Breton called the surrealists together for a meeting in order to expel Dali, who, and I quote, has demonstrated his guilt several times via counter-revolutionary actions designed to glorify the fascism of Hitler. Dali appeared at this session on February 5th, 1934, with a thermometer stuck in his mouth, claiming that he had influenza. While he spoke...
What a fucking idiot.
So because keeping a thermometer in your mouth is going to help you.
Is that where that image, like, started?
I'm getting that image of, like, the hot water.
Yeah, like a cartoon
head.
Image.
Like,
While he spoke, he kept a thermometer between his lips. And from time to time, read off the temperature.
Honestly, he was a performance artist.
Yeah, right? He defended himself against Breton's accusations by stating that the dream of the great language of surrealism could not be censored by or through logic, morals, or fear. I closed with the words, "Therefore, André Breton, if I dream tonight that we make love to one another... Tomorrow morning, I will paint our most beautiful positions in intercourse
Ooh.
With the greatest wealth of detail." Breton, mortified, his pipe clamped between his teeth, growled, "I wouldn't like to recommend you do that, my friend."
Uh-oh.
He was checkmated. Dali ended this grotesque interview by exposing his upper body, kneeling on the floor, and solemnly swearing that he was not an enemy of the proletariat. Even after the Paris group had expelled him, Dali still saw himself as a surrealist. In fact, as the only surrealist. And I quote, "The difference between the surrealists and myself exists in the fact that I am a surrealist."
Oh, okay.
Jesus.
But honestly, like, just real quick, I'm not trying to excuse Dali. But Breton was constantly trying to kick people out
yeah.
of his groups,
yeah.
okay? Like, that's yeah. just, like, a thing that he did.
Well,
he tried to do it to Duchamp. Like, he just did that.
Well,
shit.
And it was... The whole problem with Breton was that he, in theory, the Surrealist movement was this super avant-garde new thing that was supposed to be open to all possibilities. But then he was like, but only according to my rules.
Yeah, Breton came
and
along,
like,
and said, this was my club.
Yeah.
You can't be in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, I'm a lot more open to him, why he wanted to kick out Dali than why he wanted to kick out Duchamp.
Sure.
Because
right.
there was at least, like, moral, you know, reasoning.
No, yeah.
I also love in this scenario that both Dali were chewing, like, one on a thermometer and the other on a pipe. Where
yeah.
it's just like, oh, Jesus.
So,
in the manner of surrealist thought, you could get real Freudian about
definitely.
That.
Right?
And that's a thing you'll hear in some of these other stories I have as well. Salvador Dali lived his life like it was a surrealist painting. Like, there are
yeah.
so many things he did where you're just like, that's not real life.
Like, he's taking your aardvark for a walk. That's cool.
Exactly, exactly.
Totally normal.
Totally normal. So, yeah, so... Obviously, we've got some serious issues with his kind of sympathy for fascism. Then, let's see, 1934, Salvador and Gala travel to the U.S. for the first time, and the first surrealist ball is held, and I'm going to read a little bit about this because it also
wow.
just sounds really, really cool. I really would love to go to a surrealist ball.
Let's throw
I
one.
Would also
yeah.
love to go to that. Or a murder mystery party, either one.
Ooh.
A surrealist Both. Murder mystery.
Oh!
Oh!
Oh! That's a great theme for, like, a Halloween party.
Oh, okay, we're putting it in the books.
Put that down. Okay, so, let's see. She's literally putting it
She's
in the
book. She's writing it down in the book.
So, the surrealist ball. This dream ball has gone down in history as the first surrealist ball. Dali was impressed by the crazy ideas of the guests. Society women appeared with their heads stuck in bird cages and otherwise practically naked.
Great.
In the middle of the staircase, a bathtub full of water had been hung, threatened to fall and empty its contents over the heads of the guests at any moment.
Exciting.
And in the corner of the hall hung a butcher's hook with a whole hollowed out ox hanging from it. Jesus. The gaping belly of which was held open with crutches and stuffed full with half a dozen gramophones.
Yeah, that is so cool.
I know.
How do you even come
gramophones?
Gramophones. Crazy, right?
Oh, man.
So this was the life he led.
I like everything about that.
I know, right? I mean, not the dead animal so much.
I mean, it's okay.
I hope he died of natural causes.
Yeah, but I don't really like that either. So I just.
All right.
So personally, I'm not big on the.
I feel you. See, for me, I got a sort of flashback to Mexico meat markets where they have.
Yeah.
They got animals kind of just hanging. So it's kind of grotesque, but then you can have like a dope barbecue later.
For sure.
Anyway,
actually another thing that people mention. Like, Salvador Dali wasn't really a friend to animals. Granted, it was a different time. But doing stuff like that was normal. There's that famous picture of him where he's, like, jumping up in the air and there's, like, water and, like, cats.
Oh, the cats.
They had to do, like, 25 takes of that.
Oh, no.
And they were just
throwing
cats? Wet cats into the air.
Oh, poor babies.
Exactly. So, and
they're probably pissed,
the cow eyeball, like, so if you're into animal rights, also problematic. So he befriended Coco Chanel and Elsa Schiaparelli. And he designed for them, was kind of a no-no in the avant-garde art world.
Really? Oh, yeah. Because
he's doing
selling out.
Yeah, it was commercial. It was design work. And so he was kind of just like, fuck all y'all. I'm going to do this.
He didn't give a fuck.
He didn't.
Make this money.
Yeah, exactly. By the end of his life, so the last 20 years of his life, he was making bank. He is one of the wealthiest modern artists of all time.
Yeah.
He definitely wasn't the classic story of the genius who died, you know, without a penny.
Right.
Like, he made money.
Yeah. We're not shedding tears about Dali.
Which a lot of people give credit to Gala for, because she was like the business babe.
Business babe.
And then he just kind of, you know, went with it. But yeah, he made plenty of money. Beginning of the 80s, he became ill with Parkinson's.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then he had, I don't have the exact year, I think it was like 88 or 89, there was this big-ass fire in his chateau, but he survived. So he just survived this crazy-ass fire. And then he died January 23rd, 1989. So he had a long life of craziness. Some other fun stories. There are so many.
Yeah.
He once drove a Volkswagen Beetle covered in grass throughout Paris.
Sure.
Cool.
Why not?
Yeah, dude.
Volkswagen. Yeah. The car of Hitler.
Oh!
It's true.
I forgot about that.
Wait. Hitler drove a Benz.
But Volkswagen was, like, the name of Volkswagen is
the Volkswagen. Yeah.
For the people. So Volkswagen was made essentially by the Nazis.
No. Yeah, yes. It was like a, yeah.
So.
I forget about that association.
Yeah.
I
drive a Jetta, so I try to keep conscious, though.
about your German cars. Yeah. I feel you, dude.
Well, I mean, let's be real, Volkswagen's straight up fucked. Since
that
whole scandal.
Oh, yeah.
They're so fucked.
I know.
Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Don't lie about
your
product.
Why you fucking lying?
Why you always lying?
Oh, my God.
Stop fucking lying. Okay, other Dali shenanigans. He once gave a speech. He gave a speech at the 1936 International Surrealist Exhibition in a scuba suit.
Ah, yes.
And he almost died.
Oh, my God.
Of suffocation. And someone had to, like, save his ass.
That's kind of metal.
Yeah, it's like, okay.
So goofy.
He had a nickname that was given to him by André Breton. It was an acronym of his name, Avida Dollars.
which was
because he liked that cheddar. He just wanted to make money, and he was pretty greedy. So they called him that. Oh, this one I was really excited about. I'd never heard the story. So at one point in time, Yoko Ono wanted a strand of Salvador Dali's hair.
Sure.
So she contacts him.
Love her.
She's the best. It gets, oh, this is so good. She contacts him to ask him for a strand of her hair. And because he's a greedy fuck and doesn't do anything for free, he charges her $10,000, which she pays.
Oh, yeah.
So she coughs up $10,000 to get this strand of Dali's hair. And then he sends her a dried piece of grass instead of his hair because he was afraid she was going to use it for witchcraft.
I hate him. He's... Honestly, oh my god! I thought you were going to say that he sent her like a pube.
But I mean, I kind of
like
love.
He was afraid she was going to put some like bruja yeah, spell
she's
on him.
Kind exactly. Of, she's like an OG bruja. So
for real. But I love what I love about this story. It's ridiculous, but I love that he so fervently believed in the powers of Yoko to do that.
I mean,
that.
Clearly he was into some trippy shit.
Yeah,
like,
he was like, she's gonna fucking cast a hex on me or something.
On the, like, topic of Dali being super greedy, so there's this great documentary that I saw a while back. It was called Jodorowsky's Dune. So, you know Alejandro Jodorowsky. He made, like, El Topo, The Holy Mountain, these, like, weird-ass movies. Like, really great, though. So he wanted to do Dune, the movie Dune, like, from the book, right? And there is a Dune movie, but it's, like, not good. I don't like it. But there was going to be a Jodorowsky Dune, and it was going to be badass. But it just all fell apart. And a big reason why the film fell apart was because Jodorowsky thought that Salvador Dali would have been just perfect for this, like, particular character in the Dune book, this, like, sort of, like, overlord. And so he wanted Dali for this part, and Dali demanded that he get paid like a $10,000 like per second.
Oh my
god. That he was in the film, right? And like and so it just like started to fall apart when like he just like couldn't make it happen. And then a big reason why was because Jodorowsky's vision was like, I really want Dali for this part, and it just like wasn't gonna happen. Yeah.
God damn it, Dali.
Watch the documentary. It's called Jodorowsky's Dune. I think I got the monetary amount wrong, but he wanted to get paid per second.
Like bucks per second.
Yeah, yeah.
Ridiculous. Okay, so this is kind of getting into his artistic approach. He practiced what was called the paranoiac critical method. And what he would do, he would intentionally invoke a paranoid state. So he would like intentionally just make himself very paranoid, like focus on things that make you paranoid. And he would like he would invoke a paranoid state in order to deconstruct the psychological concept of identity.
Whoa.
And it's super interesting because, and you see this in his work very clearly, and this is the shit I love about Dali. Like, I love the psychology and I love how he was trying to pull apart reality. Like, I fucking love that shit. He was particularly interested in the brain's ability to connect things which are not rationally linked. So by inducing this method, he was kind of examining his own irrationality, you know, and like trying to pull apart how our brains link things that aren't rationally linked. And like, that's something we do every day, you know, that's the way human brains work. Like, every day, you know, humans aren't rational. Like, we're not naturally rational creatures. But the fact that he took it and deconstructed it and used it in art, like, I'm of the opinion that art is just a way, like, it's just another form of science. It's just a way for humans to understand their reality. Like, that's what it is. That's where it came from. And that's why we do it. And that's what he was doing, you know? He's really deeply trying to understand reality. So, paranoid critical method sounds fucking horrible. It doesn't sound fun at all, But it's really interesting.
I wonder if I should try that to write my thesis. Just, like get into the most paranoid state and, like, somehow spark creativity.
It might happen. Like, ah. Maybe try it once. See what
happens. I'm either going to write my thesis or I'm going to, like, jump in front of the Amtrak. Yeah. So we'll see. One or the other.
Exactly. And that's one of those things that's the dangers of exploring consciousness in this way, because it's fascinating, but you could also go crazy.
I don't want to know what's in my mind. It's not a good place for me.
Hit my favorite quote of his, you've seen it all over Tumblr probably, but
Tumblr.
He was once quoted as, I don't do drugs, I am drugs.
Yeah. Wow.
Which is like fair. Like, because that's another thing why I think I've been so attracted to his work for so long is because, you know, I was always a trippy kid. Like, I was always, you know, yeah. I always was kind of a weirdo and just, like, naturally attracted to what he was doing here, even though I didn't understand what it was. Like, which leads me actually perfectly to my final point, Dolly and Alice Cooper.
So,
Alice Cooper is a great example of this, because he actually went to art school. I don't know if you knew this.
Really?
Yeah, he went to art school.
But that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, he went to art school, and he actually, in this interview I was watching with him about this, he was talking about how in art school, him and all of his art school buddies, like, they just loved Dolly, and it's like, of course he did. Like, yeah. of course you did, you know?
Yeah, dude, I mean, you know, he's probably not, like, getting super deep into all of his problematic aspects, so he's probably just thinking, yo, he's cool.
Well, like, nobody was. Like, this is a new thing, recognizing how problematic Dolly is. Like, it's a thing, it's throughout history, we like to praise especially white dudes for their genius and not talk about the problems. So, this is, you know, it's not just Alice Cooper. It's like, that's what everyone was doing. Everyone just loved Dolly. But also, another personal anecdote, Alice Cooper was like my first concert when I was like 7 years old. So
I remember that story.
Yeah, I mean, technically not my first. My first was in my mama's tummy. I saw heard Robert Plant. But the first concert my dad took me to, I was like 7 years old, was Alice Cooper. So Dolly and Alice Cooper. In 1973, Dolly got really into Alice Cooper.
Couldn't be in love with 18.
I'm 18. Right?
When I was 18, yeah.
So he gets, and it makes sense. Alice Cooper had a really well-known, like, his stage show was big, and it was trippy, and it was weird. It makes sense. So Dolly sets up this meeting with Alice Cooper. He shows up for the meeting wearing a giraffe skin coat.
Sure.
Sparkly socks that were acquired from Elvis.
Oh.
And elastic boots.
Elastic boots.
I don't even know what that means. and he was accompanied by an entourage of teen girls in robes who said nothing the whole time they were there, which is weird and problematic. And Dolly gives Alice Cooper a plaster sculpture of his brain, crowned by a chocolate eclair.
Stop it.
With real ants running down the middle. He really liked ants. Salvador Dali was really into ants. And so he, like, presents this as, like, a gift. I don't know. And,
who knows?
I know. And he wants Cooper to model for him. And so what ends up happening is, obviously, Alice Cooper's like, fuck yeah. And Dali creates a revolving hologram of Alice Cooper covered in millions of dollars worth of diamonds. And biting the head of a Venus de Milo statuette. And that is a thing. And we'll put it on our sources.
It's something to behold.
There's an interview of Alice Cooper talking about it. There's also some footage of them meeting. And it's really just a whole thing that I learned about yesterday, and I'm really excited about it. Dolly, just so many stories, and there's so many more than that, like, they never end, really, but that gives you an idea of the kind of person he was. I'm gonna Woo. Pass it over to Jenny, and she's gonna.
Yeah.
She's got a good personal anecdote.
I do.
As well.
Me and Dolly have a personal experience other than me potentially being his reincarnation, which I hope I am not. Because I mean, while I appreciate Dolly and there are a lot of things that I admire about him, I've never really connected to him. Even from like a young age, I wasn't drawn to much of his work. So when I later learned things about him that were like, oh, he's kind of an asshole, it didn't bother me that much because I was like, oh, okay. But I have this very interesting experience with Dolly in that when I was an undergrad, I was interning at this really small art association in Oregon where I went to undergrad, and they had somehow come across this stereoscopic print by Dolly. And what a stereoscopic print is it's essentially two images, and then it comes with these sort of like prism goggles. And I will take pictures of all of this on our website so you can see it. But there are these little goggles with like the image of Dolly's eyes on them.
They're so crazy.
They're really cool. Fittingly, they're very trippy. So what you do is you look through these goggle things, and the two images, the two prints kind of merge together as one, and the scene that's being depicted is called Christ of Gala. And essentially what it is, it's a representation of Christ on the cross, as if the cross is down on the ground and you're crouched behind Christ's head. So you can see like the back of his head, only a little bit of his face, down to his toes. And so when you look at the two images together through the goggles, it makes it appear as if Christ is kind of hovering off of the cross. So it's pretty cool in concept. So this was the print that this small art association had. And they told me, hey, we're pretty sure this is fake, but we want you to look into it just to make sure. So I did all this research on it, and this was in 2012, 2013, so it was a while ago, but it's still relatively fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
So this particular print was purchased from a gallery in Honolulu called Center Art Galleries in the 80s. And by 1985, there were reports that were starting to emerge from various consumers of this gallery and art dealers that the gallery was selling fraudulent pieces claiming to have made by artists such as Dolly. And the majority of these fraudulent pieces were, in fact, prints. So it turns out close to 12,000 lithographs.
Whoa.
And lithographs, Jesus, is a particular kind of print, which is an engraving typically on a metal plate. So up to 12,000 prints and other works proclaiming to be Dolly's were deemed to be frauds. And this was a case that involved the U.S. Postal Service, and the U.S. Postal Service seized all of these prints from this gallery in Honolulu as part of a wire and mail fraud case against the gallery. And this is predominantly because a lot of these prints were actually sold via mail. So you would have these tourists coming in to Hawaii from Washington and California and the East Coast, and they would say, oh, we really like this print, we're going to buy it, and then they would want to buy more. And so a lot of these prints were sold by actually sending them through the mail, hence the involvement of the U.S. Postal Service. So the majority of the fake Dolly's, as I said, were prints. Many of them were reproductions from originals, like the Christ of Gala, which is actually an original print by Dolly. In 1990, a U.S. attorney estimated that between 1977 and 1989, customers who bought the Dolly reproduction prints were defrauded a total of $113 million.
Damn.
Yeah. That is a lot of money.
Yes. So how this was accomplished, there's a few reasons behind it. So what the galleries or dealers that sold to these galleries would do is they would buy these Dolly reproduction prints kind of in the range of $100 to $130. So really not that much. And then they would sell them from a quantity ranging from $1,000 to $21,500. This is the interesting point about prints. Prints in particular. The art market is a very complex thing, and we could do an episode two episodes.
We should
multiple episodes on the art market in and of itself. But the point that I want to make here in particular is about prints in the art market. So prints are can be, rather, particularly pushed into the realm of fraudulent works. So they can be subject to fraud. Buying a reproduction, as I talked about, so you buy a reproduction of a Dali print, you can label it an original. So the way that prints work, for anyone who doesn't really know, is that prints will be labeled out of a certain number of series. So you can make a series of one print, say you make like 300, so then there will be a label on that print that'll say like 1 out of 300, 150 out of 300. And so when you have a print that's kind of either the first of a series or very early in a series, that jacks up the value for it. Likewise, if a limited edition print, so this is a series of prints where perhaps the artist only made 25 editions of it, that also increases the value. So what a lot of these galleries can do in certain cases is say that these reproduction prints, like some of these ones of Dali, what these people did were to say that they were limited edition or they were first edition, and that would dramatically increase the price that they were sold for. And there's a particular forger, he's dead now, but his name is Leon Amiel, and he was a forger of prints, namely Miro, Chagall, Dali, and he is likely the most kind of common factor behind the Dali fraudulent prints that are circulating in America still today. So these prints continued to be sold even after he, Amiel, died. And often they were sold to an aware dealer who knew that they were fakes, such as a dealer named Michael Sabrin, who then, he in particular, did business with Center Art Galleries in Honolulu, Hawaii. So the owners of the gallery claimed that they didn't know that these were fraudulent. Here's where you get into the gray area, especially with fraudulent artworks, in that you have curators that are saying, oh, we didn't know. In some cases, many cases, they don't. In other cases, probably they did. and that's a whole gray area, and I'm not going to get into that per se. But there is more to these fake Dali prints than just forgers, dealers, and gallery curators. There is also at the heart of it Dali himself.
Oh!
So some Dali experts claim that Dali pre-signed a number of blank sheets.
I bet he did. He did.
That son of a bitch.
And the claim is that he pre-signed these leading up to 1980. And as Corey talked about earlier, he had Parkinson's and eventually died in 89. And for a long period from the later 80s, he was in seclusion. So there's still not a clear consensus on exactly what he was doing. But some Dali experts do say that he was signing blank sheets of paper that would then either be replicated or affixed to later forgeries. The reasons for him doing this would, of course, been to gain extra financial profits by affixing his name to reproductions of his work or work that were made in his own style.
And also maybe just to cause anarchy.
Yeah. And like we said, he liked money. Yeah. So, and the interesting thing about Dali and prints is that he didn't even really like printmaking. In his own work, he only made about 39 prints. And most prints of Dali are actually reproductions of his paintings, which he may have authorized or signed, but here we're looking at something more akin to like a signed poster, not an original limited edition print that can sell for thousands of dollars. So the thing that I want to kind of caution here for anyone who's in the art market or the print market, if you do want to collect art, prints are a good place to start because typically these are the more kind of financially friendly place to start if you are trying to start collecting art. However, prints, like I said, can be more subject to forgery. And especially if you're looking at a Dalí print, I would really caution you to be careful about it. They have been selling these fraudulent prints that have been raided from galleries like the one in Honolulu. That was not the only one by any means. There were other ones that were busted as well. And you can buy those for like $100 and they have a seal on there like, this is a forgery, which is kind of fun. That's a conversation piece. Yeah. You can have that in your house. But just, I would kind of advise exercise caution if you're looking at Dalí prints. But really, how this whole story kind of circulated back around, I did this research on this piece, and the Art Association decided, okay, since this is in fact a fraudulent print, it came from this gallery that was busted for selling forgeries, we want to cut up the print. So that it will never be sold again to some unknowing buyer for thousands of dollars. So they gave me these two, like, 4x4 pieces of paper of the print. One is of Christ's full head of hair on the cross.
That one's pretty nice, though. It is! Like, it's like a full composition, at
least. Oh, totally! Like, right? Yeah, they were mindful of that. And then the other one is Dalí's signature, and I say that with air quotes, because it also looks entirely different from his signature, which is in the box. And the box is like a work of art in and of itself almost. It's this like lovely little cubic box that has like this gold embossed signature of his on the inside with this kind of creepy depiction of his face. And then you pick out the little prism glasses, goggles to look at the print. So that's what I still have. So this is my experience with Dalí. And I've kept it all these years, and I still don't know of like a really good way to display it.
Yeah.
You know, like I have it on a shelf so people can kind of see it, but if you have any good ideas, like once I post the pictures of this, if you have any good ideas of how that I could display this in a more kind of creative, artistic way, I would love hear them.
You could maybe put this, like the prints up somewhere and have the box underneath.
What about
it,
like this?
Yeah.
So people. Yeah, like, and then you could have, like, the print above it.
See, I'm already getting ideas. Oh.
Like on the wall. Or even,
that's
like,
very cool.
You know?
Oh. Yeah. Like, and then this one, the other side.
Yeah. Like,
ooh.
So, like, this on a wall and this on, like a shelf on the wall, maybe.
Yeah.
This is, like, the coolest thing ever. And Ginny, just by the way, has, like, the coolest stuff in her house. And
does.
I just
you have
love
a lot
it.
Of random
Can
shit
I here? Also just say I'm, like, very proud of you. You're, like, a little art detective.
I know. That is so impressive.
That's really
that you
cool.
did that. Like, I'm blown away.
It was a cool experience, thanks to that art association where I used to intern. Thanks to you guys.
Yeah.
They gave me that opportunity. No, but it was very cool, and I learned a lot about Dalí just from that experience, because I did research for, like, months to be like, is this real? Is it fake? That's me and Dalí. That's me and him and our time together. And now it's about you and your time with Dalí.
So I think it would be really good to wrap up this episode in something that isn't, like, another Dalí's a piece of shit story. because he wasn't. It's just that he, you know, he was only human, okay? So,
I'm gonna have to say that he was kind of a piece of shit.
No, he was definitely a piece of shit, but he was also a human being. He also had some cool ideas. So, there's a painting by Salvador Dalí that is in the Met, and I had the pleasure of seeing it for myself over the summer. I went to New York City with my best friend, and
hey, Sonia.
Hi, Sonia. So, at the Met, I saw the painting with the title of Crucifixion in...
He did, like, the crucifixion scenes.
Yeah, he did a few crucifixions. Yeah. So this is one crucifixion, and it is crucifixion in parentheses, corpus hypercubus. And so this is a really fascinating painting, and I just really want to leave you guys off with a sort of like in-depth discussion of one of his works because, you know, we were like, oh, what should we talk about? There's so many, you know, obviously the persistence of memory is the one that almost everybody knows. Right. So, you know.
Now there's a persistence of Donald version with Trump's face.
That's look great. That we'll up. Put it up. Yeah, that one's really great. So, like, you know, there's a lot of works by Dalí that many of us are familiar with, but I feel like Corpus Hypercubicus is very much maybe a little less well-known, but if you've never seen it, please look it up because it is really, really cool. So what it is it's a crucifixion scene. It is Christ on the cross, and Christ is on a floating cross, and his body is suspended in front of the cross. In front of his body are four small cubes, and this cross is made up of cubes. Christ is in a typical, like, crucifixion pose, so he's obviously doesn't look very comfortable. He's crucified, but there are no nails through his hands or his feet, and he's in this, like, sort of space that would never exist, you know. So Dalí is well known for having these sort of compositions occurring in these vast landscapes that are in no particular place, and beneath him is what looks kind of like a tiled floor. And Gala is in the bottom left corner, gazing up at Christ on the cross. And, so it's just really a fascinating piece, and seeing it in person is so cool because, what struck me about this work was, his feet. Christ's feet are just, like, really, intense, and they just, you know, they look like feet that would have been walked on. So anyway, it's a really great painting. And so recently this painting has become a sort of focus because there's a branch of art history that has been studying Dalí and his connections with science and physics. So Dalí, his whole entire life, was really interested in not only philosophy, but also science, physics, and mathematics. So in 1975, so this is after the painting had been completed, Salvador Dalí contacted a Brown University professor, and so contacted this professor's, like, people and said, have your people talk to my people. And the professor instantly thought, just having heard about Dalí, it's either going to be some kind of hoax or he's trying to sue me.
Oh, shit.
So he just immediately thought he's trying to get something out of me. You know, because by 1975, Dalí has become notorious for these sorts of behaviors. But it ended up being that Dalí really just wanted to talk to this professor about, like, ideas. So he had all these ideas for works that would never be completed. One of which was a giant statue of a horse that was made up of three parts that were kilometers apart. And so if you stood in a certain location, it would appear to be a cohesive statue.
Gotcha.
So pretty cool. They collaborated for almost a decade. So the professor's name is Thomas Bancroft, and there's a talk that Thomas Bancroft did in 2012 at the Dalí Museum where he discusses Corpus Hypercubicus. And what he is essentially positing is that Salvador Dalí's interest in theoretical physics led him in 1954 to want to create a four-dimensional cube. And so this is obviously very difficult. A four-dimensional cube cannot exist in real life in our three-dimensional universe.
Four-dimensional anything is...
Right. So it's... He he's thinking about these ideas. And so according to this mathematician, Dali is doing his best to try to show two perspectives at once. So these are supposed to be two superimposed crosses, and you can kind of get that impression from the image. And so Dali is working off of these ideas that came out of the Cubist movement. So mm-hmm. he wasn't the first one to be concerned with the fourth dimension. So in the 19th century, these mathematicians that were coming out with all these ideas about a possible fourth dimension were just like really like fascinating these artists, like people like Picasso, people mm-hmm. like Duchamp. These people were really interested in like capturing the fourth dimension. And so we've already talked about Dali and his relationship with the Surrealists and with the Cubists, etc. So obviously he's like, I'm gonna go off and do my own fourth dimension.
Like, you know, fuck yeah. See you in the 4D.
Yeah, I'll see you in the fourth dimension. So in 1958, Salvador Dali came out with the Anti-Matter Manifesto. And he says, in the Surrealist period, I wanted to create the iconography of the interior world and the world of the marvelous, of my father Freud. Today, the exterior world and that of physics has transcended the one of psychology. My father today is Dr. Heisenberg.
Mm.
Yeah, so he's like, I'm just like beyond y'all. I'm talking about physics now. I'm a physicist now.
I have memories from being in utero.
Like, you don't even know.
Keep up.
So his interest in theoretical physics is very much like a product of the times. So it's 1954, and Dali is a creature of anxiety. And so he's influenced by these ideas of, like, Cold War fears. So now there's a threat of nuclear annihilation. And so he is trying to bridge what an art critic, this art critic Kelly Grovier, has stated that Dali, with this painting, is essentially trying to build a link between the world of spirituality, so Christ's on the cross, his salvation, the salvation of mankind through Christ, if you have that worldview, and the world of science and these geometric physical forces. So, as usual, our man is really thinking, like, I'm gonna crack the code. I'm gonna bridge the link. I'm going to bring science and art together, and it's going to be this fourth dimensional cube, and it's just...
And I'm going to save the world.
And I'm going to save the world. I'm going to save the world from nuclear annihilation. So...
It's just real.
It's, you know, and so it is just really interesting, though. It's really interesting, you know, so a cube, a regular three-dimensional cube, you could unfold it into six squares. That is called a tesseract.
Mm, I love that word.
Me too. There's like a prog metal band called Tesseract. I saw them recently. They're not that good. Sorry.
Your name's dope, though.
It's a really cool name. So a fourth-dimensional cube, then... If you were to have a fourth dimensional cube, you would unfold it into eight cubes. And so that is what we see in this cross that Christ is crucified on. So Dali is entering the realm of geometric ideas, but also the realm of the metaphysical. It's starting to seem like a natural development in his art, you know, so he's leaving the world of dreams a little bit, going into this world of metaphysical, mathematical ideas. Mm-hmm. So a couple more things about this painting. Dali claimed that this painting was metaphysical transcendent cubism.
Whew.
Oof, yeah. So he claimed that the crucifixion was influenced by a 13th century mystic and a 16th century architect.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did you say the name?
Yeah. So the 16th century architect is Juan de Herrera, and he wrote the treatise on cubic form.
Yeah.
So he was Philip II's architect. He built the Escorial Palace. And the treatise was inspired by one Ars Magna of the... He was a Catalonian philosopher and alchemist.
Oh!
Yeah.
Alchemy, it's everywhere.
It's in everything.
Anyway. Dali is then taking up these ideas into the fourth dimension. And so this professor of Brown University, Bankoff, is really into this idea, and he sees this link between Dali's hypercube, which is apparently what you call a fourth dimensional cube. And he sees
Hypercube. Also a good band name.
Hypercube. Yeah. But he sees a link between Dali's crucifix and these drawings of crosses that people that were studying perspective were doing in the 18th century. So I think, I don't know, I kind of like leaving it off on, like, a little bit of an interesting sort of fact that Dali, while he was a crappy guy... in real life, he did have some pretty interesting sort of ideas about making art, and he was fascinated by these scientific and mathematical ideas that were coming out at the time. So,
I don't think anyone would disagree with you on that.
He was a man of the times, but yes, fascism sucks, and so... do what you will with this information.
I think it's just important because obviously, like, I mean, yeah, we talked a lot about the problematic aspects of Dali, but I also started the episode talking about how he's the reason I'm an art historian. So it's like, obviously we appreciate his work and he did some, like, amazing things, but we're living in a time where it's really important that we start to think about these other aspects of these people that we idealize.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. He was by no means just some sort of eccentric, like, benign weirdo.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. He was an eccentric weirdo, but he was
not benign.
Yeah. So look forward to some more of these critical episodes, and especially look forward to our episode on Gauguin.
That one's just going to be...
That one's just going to be bashing.
That's going to be a roast of Gauguin.
I'm going to make a Gauguin effigy and light it on fire.
Yeah. No, we legitimately, Salvador Dali, we enjoy... just fuck Gauguin. Like, I don't think any of us have any positive feelings.
We gotta do that episode
to
soon.
Associate with that guy.
It's gonna be great.
He was a huge
piece
problem.
Of shit.
Yeah.
Piece of shit.
Exactly. On a completely different level. But yeah, I think that's the overall idea is, like, yeah, dive into some Salvador Dali paintings because they're fucking crazy and interesting. And if you're thinking about, like, reality and, like, you know, these different, like, psychoanalytic techniques, and you're thinking about physics and, you know, nuclear war, like, yeah, like, the material is endless. And he did also just a lot of, like, fun, weird shit, like, hang out with Alice Cooper. So, I mean, he's definitely a really interesting guy. Just don't ignore the bad thing.
Right. And be careful if you're going to buy prints.
Yeah.
Honestly, we don't even know. Like,
just probably don't do it. Unless it has a certificate that says this is a fake.
Or unless you're okay with the possibility of an inauthentic print.
Exactly.
I'm sure at some point have a whole episode on the
forgery.
We could have five episodes.
There's so much going on there, as far as what
the art market
is, yeah.
Why do we care about the authentic?
But it's also just really interesting how in issues of forgery, how so often
because museums want to believe. Mm-hmm. They want it to, mm-hmm. to be so.
Right, right. So they, like the one that we just went to. The
yeah.
Yes.
Lanaine.
The Lanaine brothers.
The Lanaine brothers.
We didn't even talk about this. We were at the Legion of Honor recently, and we're hosted.
San Francisco, by the way.
We were hosted by an absolutely amazing curator. Mm-hmm. She was fantastic and lovely.
She was lovely.
And we learned about these dudes that we didn't know about, the Lanaine brothers. And, like, there's a lot of stuff that's credited to them that isn't actually them, and it's just, like, people who buy it just want to, they just want to believe it.
The entire exhibit was, like, was it this brother? Was it that brother?
Was it no brother?
Was it any brother? We'll never know.
I almost, like, compare it to when, like, you're buying very expensive, like, facial products or something, and you're just like, I just want to believe that this will get rid of my crow's feet.
Yeah.
I just want to believe that this is an authentic piece.
Exactly.
And that it's, you know, important and valid, and it might not be, but, you know, the power of the mind is an incredible thing.
It is. It really is. But sometimes, and we'll do an episode on this, but there are some examples of forgeries that just...
Where you're like, huh?
Where you're like, there is no way that that was actually that person. Like, there is no way, but people believed it for years.
It all depends on the context,
Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, anyway, Salvador Dali, easily just one of the most interesting people of people. Like, he's just... Yeah. Interesting. So we'd love to, you know, hear your feedback or any anecdotes about Salvador you might have, because we all seem to have personal anecdotes about him.
Do you also think that you might be a reincarnation?
Let us
if
know.
If so, please contact me. Tell me what day you were born and at what time so we can compare astrological symbols.
We're trying to piece together Ginny's past life.
Yeah.
And, so if you can help in any way.
If you have any information.
We would love to hear it.
Yes. So listener mail comes to us from Sam. Hi, babes. I'm Sam. I'm an adjunct sociology faculty and a new mom. Both dope.
Those congrats.
Congratulations. That's a lot of stuff. I have been following you since your second podcast. You are amazing. Thank you. I've been learning a lot from you. Thanks for making this process so down-to-earth and fun for me. No problem, girl. That's what we're here for.
I like it.
I really enjoyed the last podcast, especially for mentioning an Iranian artist. She's talking about our Getting Graphic podcast that we did a few weeks back. Just wanted to correct her name's pronunciation. It's kind of like Marjan.
Marjan.
Marjan. So we were talking about Marjan Satrapi. Satrapi, yeah.
How did we pronounce it?
Marjane.
Oh, okay.
And who wrote the Persepolis graphic novels, and she's just also a badass. And yeah, so we were pronouncing it incorrectly. So thank you so much for the heads up. We appreciate it. She ends it, keep rocking, girls. Love you, babes. We love you, too. Good luck with just being an academic and a mom. That sounds amazing and, like, a lot of work. So.
You can do it. We have this awesome professor in our department who is just, like, the most badass babe. And she's a single mom with two girls. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, rocking. I gotta get out of lecture. I gotta go pick up my girls. They're waiting for me in the rain. And I'm like, get out of here, girl. Go pick up your kids.
And yeah, she's...
We see her around town taking her kids to karate. It's like, she just does it all.
She really does.
I love it.
She's on all of our thesis committees.
Yeah, exactly.
She's just amazing.
She's
so, yeah,
amazing.
All the luck in the world to you. Keep killing it. Thank you so much for listening. And then we have another one from Fiona. I love that name.
That's a beautiful name.
You babes are so, so, so wonderful.
Oh.
And I'm so freaking jazzed after every episode I listen to. Frida blew my mind. I'm obsessed. You are just too kind. I'm a third year at the University of Virginia studying public policy and took a class on Impressionism and Post-Impressionism on a whim last semester. The first art history class I've ever taken in my life. I know I don't have to describe to you the experience of looking up at a work of art you've never given a second thought to before and feeling that incredible spark in your heart and brain and gut.
Yeah.
We know that vibe for sure. Given the current state of our government and the political atrocities that are certain to come, what would you say is the most dire problem facing the arts right now? I'm interested in the role that I can play as a policy student recently aware of how lit art is. As super smart women who've been studying art for as long as you have, what would be the best thing government could do for the arts and the worst? Thank you so much for your smart, inspiring, hilarious podcast. Please keep making more so I can keep learning about how cool art is. Your fan, Fiona. Thank you so much, Fiona. Ooh. So many nice words. Also, the fact
really
that...
Really good questions.
Yeah, the fact that you're trying to, like, merge public policy and art is just, like, so dope. It's, like, such a dope thing to be doing.
It's very needed as well.
Yeah, so...
The worst thing...
What's the worst thing that government could do for the arts right now?
Cutting funding.
Which, yeah.
For different art programs, art camps... Especially, like, art in elementary school, middle school, high school, cutting all of that would be the worst.
Arts are so just important to little growing brains. Like, yeah. They're just really important.
I think the next few years are going to be very dark times for the arts. Yeah. They were just hanging something in our building in Everson yesterday morning that was just... all about Trump's administration wanting to cut funds to the arts and humanities, and which isn't something like, and I feel crazy saying this because I'm not trying to make any kind of excuse for Trump and his administration, but the arts and humanities have been under attack for years and years, and it's just getting worse.
Yeah, he just wants to wipe them
out. He just wants it gone, and honestly, I just think that one of the biggest challenges to the arts are government bodies coming out vocally saying arts education is not useful, or, you know, you're just going to waste your time if you major in blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that the most damaging actions that we're experiencing are in taking away funds and also, like, public figures saying, like, in a public forum that the arts are not.
Right.
Like,
and it's just misinformed. Yeah. It really is. It's misinformed to say something like that.
Yeah.
And I think bottom line is we live in an increasingly visual culture. And it's no longer just about art or art history or history. It's about living in a world where images have power. Images have always had power. And images will always have a presence and a power, even if you technically don't believe in them. That's why they are constantly remade, destroyed. That can't be ignored. So moving beyond that, in terms of things you can do that are related to policy, are just pushing the funding of programs that facilitate art and art education.
And the humanities in general. It's all interrelated.
And arts and sciences. So many people don't seem to get that, like, the arts and the sciences really go hand in hand in a lot of ways. And I think the sciences in many ways are also under threat with the current administration. Yeah. Like, hello.
Intellectualism is under threat.
So in trying to preserve and promote and defend and support the humanities and the sciences in general is a good, really good place to start. I wish I had more specific
that's also something for all of our listeners and for all of us. My cousin posted this thing on Instagram today, and it was like just a list of advice from, I think it was Martin Luther King Jr.'s, I don't know if it's his daughter, maybe someone related to Martin Luther King Jr. And it was like a list of advice of how to handle the situation. And there's like five things on it. And one of them was support the arts.
Yeah.
Like, support the arts as much as possible, because the arts is where you're gonna have people speaking out against these things.
Exactly, and that's how it's been for centuries.
Yeah, like, the arts is where revolutions start. Like, so the best thing, like, because I totally agree with what you're saying, that in the idea that it's gonna be a dark time because arts programs are gonna probably lose funding or they're gonna be under attack and stuff. But on the flip side, I think it's gonna be a beautiful time for art of all kinds, because it's when shit like this happens that people, that's when the art gets good. That's when, like, stuff, like, really good stuff comes out.
It's gonna get good. I think that what I meant by that is that, you know, things like funding, things like spaces to create, like, those kinds of things are going to be harder to come by.
Yeah, the making of it isn't going to be any easier.
Like, the people that are graduating with degrees in art studio are going to have a hard time. Like, people like us are going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
But it's also, on the flip side of that, is that nothing is ever going to stop art making. It's an innately human thing to do.
Exactly.
And
it'll be scribbling on cave walls.
Yeah. Like, after the nuclear holocaust, we'll be using our three arms to make some crazy shit that you've never seen before. So,
that'd be great. But yeah, so in this particular situation, public policy wise, just anything to fight for education,
yes,
and arts education,
yes,
is definitely going to be the best use of your abilities and your time. Also, I mean, just things you can do with public policy in the arts is issues of, was it repatriation? When basically cultural heritage or art of a certain culture gets stolen by colonialism, trying to help get it back. That's kind of a thing
that's especially relevant in our country, where you have different artworks that are displayed in museums from Native American tribes that are not meant to be displayed. So there are current ongoing cases, legal cases of this, where tribes are trying to get these pieces back. I think in any way you can support different groups in the United States that have been oppressed for a long time. If you can support different art coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement, if you can support art that's coming out of Native American groups and, the repatriation of getting those specific pieces back of theirs that were not meant to be displayed in museums, but were put there in the 20th century or whatever, things like that can really help as well, kind of on a more political, systemic level. There's a lot. There's a lot to do.
Yeah, there's not much to do.
And I'm sure there's more that we're missing. So also, if listeners hear this and they think of anything else, we would love to hear, and we can spread the word on that.
Yeah. Best thing we can all do is just keep supporting each other and supporting the arts and
keep doing shit.
Fucking fighting, man. Yeah. Resist.
Yeah. And I'm seeing it. Okay. So tonight, Natalie is visiting this art street that is happening in Sacramento. And it is this really cool thing where they're building these condominiums just sort of on the fringes of the edge of Sacramento, and there's abandoned warehouses out there. And so a group of people just got together and decided let's turn this space into gallery space. And so it's really, really cool. And that kind of pop-up art installation stuff, I'm crazy about that.
Oh yeah.
That's so cool.
It's great. Make art, support art.
Talk about it.
Talk about art.
Be art.
Be art. For real. That's my life goal is just to be art.
Yeah.
And it should be everybody's life goal. We're just all walking art beings.
Yeah.
What a lovely world it would be.
I feel warm and good.
Yeah. So there's lots you can do, but
thank you for that question.
That was a wonderful question.
That was good. Yeah, it really sparked a lot of conversation.
I'm still going to be thinking about it while I'm lying in my bed later tonight.
I'm going to be thinking about it when I go home and eat a burrito.
So thank you for the great question. Please, we'd love to hear any other ideas, feedback, thoughts on how we can use the arts in this current political climate, because it's not going away anytime soon. So
the power of the image lives on.
Yes. Thank you so much for listening to our episode on Salvador Dali. Hopefully you learned something.
Some things.
I think they learned a lot.
I think you're gonna have some good stories, at your next cocktail party.
Just YouTube Salvador Dali and you'll find some crazy shit.
It's a rabbit hole.
It'll be fun.
It's a great rabbit
hole.
Thank you so much for listening. Check out our website, www.arthistorybabes.com. Like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram @Art History Babes Podcast, Twitter @Art History Babes.
Write us a review on iTunes. Those yes, are so great.
So good.
And so lovely.
Check out our Patreon.
Yeah, if you wanna help support the arts, patreon.com/arthistorybabes. We appreciate it. It's really great. Every time. Every little dollar really does help. We're it not really just does. Saying that. Like no, it does. No, it really does.
We're just trying to make this podcast better for you.
Yeah, we're doing this for you. No, but seriously, thank you guys so much for listening and all your shout outs and support and fan mail. It like just keeps us going and keeps us excited.
I read it when I'm sad.
Yeah.
And then I feel better.
I know. It's so true. It's so real. Yeah. Whenever
you
I have.
You guys are the best.
You really are. Like, whenever I'm having, yeah, like a not feeling great about, you know, what I'm doing, like, with my life kind of a moment, I'm just, like, I think podcast, and I'm like, hey, those people like us. Those people appreciate what
they
we do.
They really like me.
Yeah, so thank you so much, and we will see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, we love you.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here.
Go off and do my own fourth dimension. Like, you know, fuck yeah.
See you in the 4D.
Yeah, I'll see you in the fourth dimension.